We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft. But Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink. Which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Welcome to the Solid Verbal.
The Solid Verbal.
Come after me! I'm a man! I'm 40!
I've heard so many players say, well, I want to be happy. You want to be happy for a day? Eat a steak.
It's that woo woo!
And now, Dan and Ty.
Welcome back to the Solid Verbal, boys and girls. My name is Ty Hildenbrandt. Joining me, as always, over there in the burbs of Chicago, the fugitive of this show, Dan Rubenstein, sir. How are you?
I'm pretty good. It's telling that, when did we start this show? We started this show in 2008.
So, yeah.
12 and some odd months ago, 12 years and however many months. I can't remember ever thinking to myself, oh, I should definitely pee before doing the show. And here we are. I think we both pee now regularly before the show.
We do.
Because we
do.
Want to give our best and fullest selves to the Verballers. I didn't plan on starting my conversation like this, but here we are.
I don't want to be distracted, Dan. I want to make sure that I'm focused, that I'm listening, that I'm present
in
each and every moment, and that I can give the best show possible. Hello, welcome back. A very awkward way to start the show. That's what we're here for, though. It is March. It still is a college football show. We've got college football content that we're going to present.
Welcome to Bladder Talk.
Bladder Talk.
Shoots and Bladder.
Yeah. Shoots and Bladders? Okay.
Yeah, not bad.
SolidVerbal@gmail.com is the way you can get in touch. Also going out to the website, solidverbal.com, or hit us up on social media. Verballers.com is where you can go and find out all you need to know about our Patreon. We had a bit of a scheduling change. I think on the last show we discussed that we were going to do childhood movies with Bill Barnwell.
Yeah, kids sports movies from the 1990s with our friend Bill Barnwell of ESPN. It's NFL free agency week. So this is one of his absolute busiest times. So we are pushing that until next month for our Patreon subscribers. Learn more at verballers.com. Yeah.
In lieu of that awesome idea, which I was excited about and still am excited about.
Of course.
We're going to do a different off topic. Again, only available to Patreon subscribers.
Bladder Talk.
Bladder Talk coming in a very strong second.
Okay, good.
Personal tech, Dan.
Yes.
Personal tech.
What is that?
What does that mean to you?
What does government mean to me? What does personal tech mean to me? Anything that we used growing up as children, high school, college, be it for video games, music, television, computing, any sort of gadgetry that is digital and can be considered to be using technology. So it's a pretty loose term. And then up and through what we've used now, what we use now on an everyday basis and what we hope to have in our lives, I suppose, in the next year to 5 years.
So we need to devote a serious amount of time to the Nokia 5650, the phone that everybody had. Literally everybody our age had that phone.
I was hoping you were going to say the Game Gear TV adapter that used 8 AA batteries every 20 minutes. Yeah.
So we got a lot to discuss here. Again, that show is only available at verballers.com. Check it out for more information. Okay. On today's show, Dan, we're keeping with that theme. The NCAA tournament is starting on Friday, apparently, which I just discovered via text message with Illini fan Scott.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I had no idea that this is a Friday type of thing now. But
playing Drexel, nearby Drexel, the Dragons.
The Dragons, that's true.
Just another one of the Pennsylvania teams that has made the tournament since Penn State last did. I looked it up in 2011.
Penn State just hired the assistant from Purdue.
The assistant from Purdue.
Yeah, it's he's got a funny name.
Okay.
Shrewsbury. It's not Gene Katie. Shrewsbury. I'll look it up. I just read about it this morning. I had no idea.
Penn State lost by 2 to Temple in 2011, another Pennsylvania team that has repeatedly made the tournament since Penn State last did. I looked it up, Ty, because this is what I do. The number one movie of the week, the day that Penn State last appeared in the NCAA tournament was Rango.
Rango.
Johnny Depp. Rango, playing a chameleon. The number three movie was Red Riding Hood, starring Amanda Seyfried from...
Allentown, PA. Allen High represents.
There's your full circle. Okay, continue.
Micah Shrewsbury, by the way.
Okay.
Assistant. Cool. From Purdue.
So what are we using as inspiration?
We are using upsets, buzzer beaters, as inspiration, Dan.
The slipper still fits!
Little Gus Johnson as some inspiration here. We have gone through our... friend Bill Connolly's piece that he put out on ESPN.com. I don't think it was recent. When did he publish this?
Probably a couple months ago. A
couple months ago. Talking about the top 25 games of the 2020 season. We picked out our favorite five upsets that we could
upsets,
delve into.
Upsets, buzzer beaters, something that came down to the wire. Yeah, something in the vein of what attracts people to the first round of the NCAA tournament.
And so we decided we wanted to dissect these from a couple different angles. We wanted to talk about the circumstances going into the game, where each team was, what the storylines were going in, how our perception changed after. Just kind of a deep dive, a quick glancing blow, an oral history of some of these games as it was to be a fan in 2020.
As two people not there. Games.
Nobody was there. In most cases. True.
Depending on the game, yeah. It's dealer's choice. We came up with five games. Do we have any news? Do you have any like things you want to get to before we dive in?
Well, we have to get to the Patriot League later.
Oh, true. Yeah,
that's the only other pressing thing that I have at this point.
Right.
Do you want to start with LSU, Florida?
I would love to. Let's start LSU, Florida. Which was number one, right, on Bill C's list of the best games of the season. And I want to go through, as we talk about these games, because, yes, it was clearly an upset. LSU had a crazy down season, and the game was in Florida, and LSU was starting, what, their third-string quarterback for the first time in this game, and Max Johnson?
Correct.
I want to go through and sort of dissect and discuss upsets in general. Like, what are the factors? What goes into the cocktail of a college football upset? Because I think... we're going to find ingredients, mixers in this cocktail that are a through point in all of these games, the connective tissue in all five of these games, not necessarily upsets, but a team either completing the upset or getting close or cinching the game with a buzzer beater or holding off a team that was going to upset that team. I think we want to find that connective tissue, especially as we look forward to games and say, ooh, could this be? Could there be the elements? Could there be the mixers?
Well, I mean, there is definitely a through line for four of the five that we're going to discuss. The oddball is Coastal and BYU.
Maybe. I don't even know. I have a connective tissue all five, but continue.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most obvious thing is that you're talking about a team with lofty expectations, perhaps title, playoff, conference championship aspirations. Mm-hmm. And they get knocked off by a team that nobody expects them to get knocked off by. So, like, you know, if we stick with Florida and LSU, Florida going into that game had lost in week three of the season on the road to A&M, but otherwise looked pretty killer. They had beaten Georgia. They were number six in the college football playoff rankings, and they were going to get a crack at Bama in the SEC title game. So for LSU to knock off Florida. LSU was 3-5 headed into that game. The myth that LSU was going to go on some run to follow up the Joe Burrow season had long diminished. They were terrible.
Yeah.
Maybe terrible is too strong a word, but
That's too strong. They were disappointing.
They were disappointing. They were off back-to-back losses coming into that game against A&M and Bama. They had also lost a couple weeks earlier to Auburn. They lost week one against Mississippi State. Remember, that's when everyone thought that the Mike Leach experiment was going to be, taking the conference by storm.
Yeah.
They had no quality wins at this point. They almost lost to Arkansas a couple
weeks
prior.
And that Bama game was the game that featured Devontae Smith hauling in like 230 yards worth of catches in the first half. Yeah,
exactly. So, you know, LSU by no stretch is an underdog story, but they were disappointing at the point in the season when they played Florida. And Florida definitely had some SEC championship aspirations. They were going to get a crack at Bama. They knew it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, at least from our standpoint coming into this game, I remember when we previewed it, we felt like this was kind of a foregone conclusion that Florida was just a lot better than LSU, that LSU was kind of a mess. They had this new quarterback situation. We were sorting it out. We just didn't expect much out of LSU, and Florida had a lot to play for. So for me, the through line with this game for Florida, certainly, and some of the others that we're going to discuss, was we had a team with lofty expectations that ultimately was felled by a team that did not.
Yeah. I think what I have through all five of these, the connective tissue, is there are unexpected wrinkles.
Sure.
Both in terms of the environment, in terms of the context of the game, and in terms of something unexpectedly novel, no pun intended with the novel coronavirus, of course. And the wrinkles in this Florida LSU game were pretty vast, right? So Florida has no idea what to expect from a Max Johnson offense, from a freshman starting. They don't really know how to game plan for. I mean, obviously, he does not destroy Florida. He's fine and does make plays, but that's ultimately not the biggest reason why LSU won this game. You have the wrinkle of the fog. You have the wrinkle of a killer penalty at the end of the game to extend a drive for LSU, Marco Wilson and the shoe throw.
Yeah.
You have uncharacteristic mistakes and turnovers from Kyle Trask. He goes 43 touchdowns to 5 picks. Two of those picks were in this game. One of them was the pick six. It was Eli Ricks. And the other one was a freak red zone interception. And he also had a fumble. So there is something about any upset, and we all know this, that if two teams are going head to head and there are not a lot of mistakes made and the environment is fine and normal, the better team's going to win an overwhelming number of those games. And Florida was clearly heading into that game the better team. Another wrinkle, Kyle Pitts does not suit up for Florida.
Right.
Now, Kadarius Toney is incredible and did plenty to win this game himself with his playmaking along with Kyle Trask. But there is something about, I mean, really, what is it? Cade York, the kicker, with just an uncharacteristically vast, successful game-winning, ultimately game-winning kick. Not a buzzer beater, because Florida had an opportunity at the end of the game to kick their own kick to ultimately win the game. But the wrinkles involved with, I think, a 57-yarder in the fog, so foggy that the wire cam had to take over as the main camera.
Incredible, right? It was like pea soup.
It was. It absolutely was. And so the wrinkles involved in this game, a game in which Florida fully outgained LSU healthily, I think it was by like 200-ish yards.
Oh, they killed him. Yeah.
All of that is to say, LSU was good enough to take advantage of mistakes, to be in the right position to take advantage of those mistakes. And those mistakes are both mental and physical for Florida, if you look at the shoe throw, but that ultimately is not what lost Florida the game. But the broader capital M mistakes on Florida's part is what lost the Gators the game. And it cannot be stressed enough that of all of the ways to lose a football game in an incredible upset, a 57-yarder on the road in a hostile environment in dense, dense fog.
In the fog.
Seems like the least likely. And so this is a tip of the cap just in terms of degree of difficulty. Because one of the other through points, if you look at a lot of these games, and it's not necessarily true dramatically in all of these, is who's picking up free yards? Who's returning an interception? Who is bringing a punt back 64 yards? Who is bringing an interception back to the opponent's 8-yard line? When you get outgained, you're not necessarily knowing the full story because there are free yards to be picked, a penalty yards, Ty. All of these things go into upsets, and LSU just kept hitting. They kept checking all of those notches, all those boxes.
Do you know?
So incredible.
Do you know, according to Bill Connolly and his SP Plus advanced metrics, what the post-game win expectancy was for LSU and what the adjusted scoring margin was?
So this is him taking all of the numbers, the success rates, and saying, okay, a team that is outgained and has this percentage more in terms of explosive plays, this is how often they will win a game when they have these advantages.
Correct. So that's post-game.
It has to be, yeah.
Post-game win expectancy measures that. Adjusted scoring margin looks at the same stuff, but then puts a point value on it. So
right.
Case in point, LSU had beaten South Carolina earlier in the year by a 52-24 score, mm-hmm. 28 points. When Bill C. crunched the numbers, the adjusted scoring margin, in that game was that LSU was only about 13 points better, right?
Right.
In this Florida game, LSU's post-game win expectancy was 1%.
That's wild.
1%.
I was going to guess 85 in terms of Florida, 85-15.
1% wow. For LSU. I'm guessing the 1% comes into play because of that goofy penalty and how that right. threw things in favor of LSU and gave them a shot. The adjusted scoring margin was that even though the final score indicated LSU won by a 37-34 final, he has that Florida was actually 24 points better. Which is
Malik
lot.
Davis, who led Florida in rushing, averaged 11.6 yards per carry. Kadarius Toney, of course, the Swiss Army knife for the Gators, 18.7 yards per rush, 3 carries for 56 yards. So if my math serves, it's something like 10 carries for 137, I think, yards in a losing effort by Florida's top two rushers. And Kadarius Toney also finished with nearly 200 yards through the air. Perhaps we should have issued a trigger warning for Florida fans before talking about the depths of the improbabilities of this loss. But yeah, it's even though Max Johnson didn't shred Florida, he was fine. He didn't throw any picks.
No picks.
He made a couple of huge plays when there were coverage busts, when a corner would blitz and a receiver was wide open. He threw a really nice touchdown pass early on. And it was just who stole more of those free yards? I mean, LSU was more penalized. LSU didn't. I mean, it was just that pick six and the way Florida's offense stalled in the second half with LSU eventually taking advantage that on top of all of the capital M mistakes, won the game for LSU. So improbable, but certainly I think in line with how any team upsets another team. Do you have the spread in this game? I can look it up.
I don't have it. No, not in front of me.
But no, I think it's full on matches with my elixir.
Yeah, the storyline going in was that Florida's going to get a crack at Bama, and this is mm-hmm. another speed bump. Because LSU had not shown much promise. Again, they had lost two in a row. The storyline coming out.
24-point favorites.
24, yeah.
Yep.
The storyline coming out was that Florida shot itself in the foot, somewhat literally with the shoe penalty that put LSU in field goal range. And also, I think on the LSU side, a bit of promise. Because you mentioned Max Johnson, and the numbers weren't eye-popping. 21 of 36, 239 passing, 3 touchdowns, no picks. But he showed a command of the offense that couldn't really be represented by any of the numbers. He just really looked comfortable running
the
system.
First start in the swamp, in the fog of his career.
Really comfortable. And that was a bit of promise for LSU that they took away from it. So, fun game. Bill C. had this one as number one in 2020. Where do you want to go next?
Let's go. Do you want to go to that Coastal BYU game?
Let's save that one for... Let's talk about the Civil War, shall we?
Let's talk about Civil War. Let's go across the country or whatever we're going to call that matchup moving forward.
Oh,
sorry.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Oregon State, Oregon. Still the Civil War to me. Maybe to you.
Okay.
Oregon State wins 41-38. Oregon headed into this game was 3-0. They had just beaten UCLA by a 38-35 margin. And they were ranked 11th in the AP Top 25. Oregon State 1-2. They just beat Cal, but They had lost to both the Washington schools in the first 2 weeks of the year. Didn't look like Oregon State was exactly going to go on some Cinderella run to win the Pac-12.
Right.
The storyline going into this game, at least for me.
By the way, everybody watching this game, I think it was the only game on.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
At the moment, yeah.
Exactly. Storyline going in, for me, kind of the same going out. And it wasn't so much a definitive as it was a question. Is this a lost season for the Pac-12? Does it really count? Does Oregon have a realistic shot at the playoff? Or really anything outside of winning the Pac-12, given the odd circumstances that led to a very abbreviated Pac-12 season, Dan? What was your take on that? What was your take on that? Because I recall us having a conversation where you were like, yeah, Oregon's not good enough to be much of anything.
Well, this was sort of at the height of the broadcasters treating every game as if it's important if it has clear playoff implications. We're not talking about any sort of important game if it doesn't have playoff implications. So that sort of set me off during the season of like, what, could we just watch a football game and enjoy it and hope for a fun finish and good performances? So, yeah, this was clear in this game, watching this game, because they were undefeated. They were 3-0 coming 3-0. Into this game, yeah, I believe. Yeah. I was not a big believer in Oregon, and the passing game started showing some weakness and some struggle. UCLA was blitzing the hell out of Tyler Shuck, and he was struggling with that. So there were some moments, and they were kind of sloppy against Wazoo, but they pulled that out in a strong second half. Oregon looked like they were going to run away with this one. They scored 21 within the first quarter and 3 or 4 minutes. They were humming offensively and getting enough stops. The issue is they weren't tackling all game long. Even when they were getting stops, they weren't tackling. And tackling is about effort. I'm not going to accuse Oregon players of not playing with effort, but for whatever reason, they were not tackling well in this game. And there's another game that can be highlighted with that lack of tackling acumen that we're going to get into as well. So what struck me about this game is Oregon as a team on both sides of the ball, they came up short situationally and in high leverage moments, even though they got a stop with, I think, 2 minutes left in this game, up. They're winning in this game with 2 minutes, and they get a stop deep in their own territory. Oregon State's driving. They go for it on 4th and 10, and Oregon gets a stop. So they essentially need a first down or two to ice this game. And they immediately get two basically nothing gains on the ground to let the clock tick and have Oregon State call timeouts. And then they throw it, which is controversial, right? The idea of 3rd and 10, we can take 40 seconds off with an inconsequential run and punt it. Or force a team to, I don't recall how many timeouts Oregon State had left in that moment. I don't know if they had any. But in any case, that's the conservative yet somewhat, if not usually, effective move, right? Play clock.
Right.
So they decide to pass it. And it was another example of Oregon really struggling through the air. Tyler Shuck struggling to lead this offense in a high leverage moment late in the game. And threw a nothing incomplete pass, gave the ball back to Oregon State. Oregon couldn't get any drops. Their linebackers struggled in coverage this game. And this was another foggy game, by the way.
Yeah.
So there's your wrinkle. There's a wrinkle. It's a rivalry game with fog. And LSU Florida is its own rivalry, of course. But it's a rivalry game with fog. With, I think Oregon's missing a key receiver. I don't think Micah Pittman played in this game. But whatever. Everybody's missing players all season long in 2020. And just looking uncomfortable, whereas Oregon State was coming up big. Tristan Jebbia came up really nicely in big moments. Jamar Jefferson obviously ran all over Oregon State. And Oregon did have a shot at the end of this game to get, I suppose, into field goal range. But at this point, Oregon didn't really have a kicking game to speak of. So I don't know how much of an option that was. But those last two drives for the Oregon offense were indicative of a team that was not prepared to close out games, no matter the quality of opponent. And so Oregon State just showed up to the game, showed up to the moment and made those plays. And there were the stops at the end of the game that, you know, Oregon was trying to get a goal line stand. And ultimately that took off a lot of time and Oregon State eventually punches it in. And there was no real cohesive plan at the end of the game for Tyler Shuck to go downfield successfully. He threw it in double coverage a couple times. And Oregon State, the clear better team, won at home in the fog, and I can pull up the spread in this game, but it was striking to see how much over the course of the game this Oregon offense stalled.
Right.
Like it came out in such impressive fashion. And the through point is winning on the road is tough. Winning on the road in the fog is tough. And Oregon State was sort of a team with nothing to lose. They outgained Oregon. They played hard and they rose to every large occasion. And Oregon, by the way, with three turnovers and Oregon State with none, still with an opportunity to win.
Yeah, and still with a 62% post-game win expectancy.
Sure.
Which, if you've turned the ball over a couple times like that, you don't usually have a number that high. Bill C still has them as about a three-point victor in the game, kind of, again, adjusted scoring margin. So a close game by any stretch. He's not looking at this one in the same manner that he did the Florida LSU game. It was obviously much tighter. You know, rightly or wrongly, Dan, after Oregon dropped this game, we still covered the Pac-12. We always cover everybody. But in my mind, I sort of just like lost a lot of the expectations I had for the Pac-12.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like there was something, I was going to say something interesting about LSU Florida. It was not a high quality football game.
No,
it was a gutty win for Oregon State, but it's not like you left that game thinking, man, just haymakers after haymakers and somebody had to lose. Damn.
And I think we've been conditioned to look at a week, 13 game? Rivalry game? Like it's got some real national significance. And in hindsight, none of these games really did. They didn't really. And after Oregon lost, it was kind of like the dam broke for me. And I just kind of didn't care about the Pac-12 in the same way that I might otherwise, which is through no fault of the Pac-12. But
yeah,
it was really hard to get jazzed up for Pac-12 football after what I thought was the best team in the conference lost on the road to its biggest rival.
I think that's correct. Yep.
All right. Let's go to Indiana Penn State.
Let's. Oh, man. There's a lot to unpack here.
So this is different because I think all the other games that we're going to discuss happened after teams had played at least one game. We're going to talk about Texas Tech. That was the second game of the year for both teams. But in the case of Penn State, Indiana, both teams were unbeaten and untested because it was week one.
Yeah, this is an upset of expectations.
Of the season. Remember now, the Big Ten season was delayed until week eight of the larger season that was 2020. So we really had no idea what to expect. We were both pretty high on Indiana. We liked Indiana. We felt like they were building something. We still do. Penn State had gotten a lot of acclaim going into this season. They had Micah Parsons, who was opting out, but I think we still thought very highly of what Penn State could do. And despite the fact that we didn't really know what to expect, it was kind of a thought that Penn State is going to play Ohio State pretty early on in the year. And that could benefit Penn State because, you know, Ohio State's maybe they're going to be a little untested. Maybe because of COVID, they're not going to be.
They had lost a bunch of key guys on defense. Yeah.
The secondary, right? We had questions. Like, Penn State could take advantage of this. So, going into the game, I think we were pretty excited about it. I remember watching on my patio, on my iPad, and just being transfixed by the way that this game unfolded. If you look at Bill C's post-game win expectancy, the takeaway here is that Penn State played well enough to win. And he had them at a 95% post-game win expectancy that they were 15 or 16 points better than Indiana. But Indiana capitalized on the opportunities that it did get. And this one had an unbelievable ending. It went to overtime. Indiana eventually ends up winning 36-35, going for two in overtime. That amazing play where Michael Penix scrambles to his left. He lays out, dives towards the pylon. The refs gave it to him. Replay was inconclusive. I still feel like he was short.
Okay.
But he got the call, and there wasn't enough to overturn it. Regardless of how you feel about that play, an incredible individual effort by Penix to at least give his team a shot
right
to win the football game. So a lot to unpack about the game itself. The immediate takeaway for me was that Indiana was legit. And also that Penn State had played well enough to win in some regard. The longer term takeaway is actually a lot more interesting to me, because it was still that Indiana was legit, a really good team. Nobody will deny that. But also that a little bit of the luster of that Penn State win had faded, if only because Penn State started 0-5.
Right.
And they lost to Ohio State. And then they lost to Maryland and Nebraska and Iowa. It took them a while to get it together. Down the stretch, they got better. And they ripped off a couple wins to close out the season. But certainly by virtue of Penn State losing a bunch, four games after that Indiana game, it was a little bit of a diminished accomplishment for Indiana, rightly or wrongly?
Wrongly. I mean, look, Indiana did not play that good of a game. This was not... Well, LSU played an interesting game against Florida. They made big plays. They came up big in big moments, and same can be said for Oregon State. The plays were made. Indiana on offense especially. I mean, we're talking about what? Penn State missed three field goals, one of which was a 25-yarder?
Yes.
They commit 10 penalties for 100 yards, so which is okay in week one, right? You can get things fixed. I mean, not that Penn State necessarily did in terms of mistakes, but the game was there for Penn State, as you mentioned. And Indiana, I suppose, what's the adage of like, you don't have to be faster than a bear, you just have to be faster than your friend?
Faster. You don't have to be faster than the bear, just faster than your buddy. Yeah.
Right. And so I in rewatching this game, it was pretty obvious to me that both Indiana and Penn State slathered themselves in beef and then decided to run into an area populated by, you know, mistake-prone bears, which is what this game was, a giant mistake-prone bear coming for somebody. And so Penn State makes those mistakes, and even that first drive is a 13-play drive. And the thing that was striking about, and I didn't watch this game first, is the Penn State offense, intentionally or not, was basically built around like, hey, we're going to run RPOs and hope for 6 or 7 yards, and maybe we'll get 3 or 4. And there is something so dangerous about trusting college kids to execute fully, all 11 dudes, for long drives. And that ultimately is, aside from the field goal, I mean, Sean Clifford was off, and you guys were getting beat repeatedly in one-on-one matchups. And there was just something about Indiana hanging around. Was that Marcy Playground, the first line of Sex and Candy? This was a hang-around game for Indiana. Obviously, Sean Clifford connects with Jahan Dotson late for that big, I think it was a 60-yard touchdown. But otherwise, there was not much to either one of these offenses, and Indiana took advantage when they could, and the defense played pretty well and just kept Penn State's offense in check. But offensively, there was nothing remarkable about Indiana rising to the moment. So this is one of those games where somebody has to win. Somebody has to win. And that play was that wrinkle, I suppose, in terms of this game. That freak play in overtime. But this was not a classic upset, more of a happenstance kind of upset. And that's okay. But the wrinkle was that it's week one, and that Penn State uncharacteristically maybe characteristic for 2020, but just a myriad of mistakes.
Yeah.
And that's where Indiana was able to take advantage of those free yards.
And I seem to recall going into this game that one of our talking points on the preview show was that you should take Indiana in the points. What did we say that the point spread was here?
I'm looking it up
right
now. Might
have been like 5 points. I forget, but it was a lower number.
7 points, touchdown.
Yeah. I remember saying this is a great place to take Indiana, because what we were seeing as a trend at that point was in the early part of the season for pretty much every team, they were playing below expectations. There was just such goofy circumstances that brought us to the start of the season at all that it was a bridge too far to expect that anyone was going to go out there and just be killer. So hopefully you cashed Indiana in getting the plus value there.
Yeah. I would be thrilled to have.
Plus 205 money line. So you're getting 2-1 odds on Indiana to win outright.
It was such a bad offense to watch of Penn State's, even aside from the interceptions. It was just, it felt like they were trying to win 5-yard fields.
Yeah, all year.
all year. And there's, if you watch that Sark clinic talk that he gave, right? Where he talked about how he almost never, if ever, has routes run by Alabama receivers that involve them stopping and sitting in zones or, stopping around, come back. Like, he doesn't have that. He wants his receivers catching the ball in stride just because he wants explosive plays. He doesn't want to trust 11 guys working perfectly together for 11, 12, 13 plays every drive. And there was something about that Penn State offense where, like, I hear you, but what if we just 4.5 yarded at a time? It was tough.
All right.
And that's why they made a change.
Let's go to the great state of Texas, Dan.
Oh, my God. What a game.
Both teams had played one game. Texas Tech barely beat Houston Baptist, 35-33. Bill Connelly had them losing by 3 or 4 points post-game adjusted scoring margin. So not a great start for Texas Tech and Matt Wells. On the Texas side, they were 1-0. They were a top 10 team. They had just completely retooled offense and defense in the offseason. So a lot of promise for Tom Herman coming into this year with what they could do with this new staff. Now, I think in hindsight, we recognize really difficult circumstances. We say it 1,000 times a show. Difficult circumstances to install anything new. You're doing calls and game planning over Zoom. Like, it's just, it was not optimal for anybody. But the playing field was level in that regard. The storyline going in was that Texas had all this hope. The storyline coming out was, okay, we beat Texas Tech by 7 in overtime. Maybe still a work in progress, Dan.
Scratched and clawed.
Maybe not quite the upset, but Herman needed to shape up.
It was a buzzer beater, though. It ended with a pick at the end, right?
Yes. Yes, it did.
Okay, that's a buzzer beater in its own way.
Texas followed up this effort by dropping 2 straight to TCU and Oklahoma. And maybe this was a harbinger of things to come. I don't know. Obviously, Tom Herman is no longer the head football coach at UT at Austin. But this is a fun game. There's a lot of offense, right? There was a lot here from a fan standpoint to just watch and enjoy the points. But certainly, if you were a Texas fan, this was not the showing that you wanted on defense.
Do you know how hard it is for Texas to be down, they were down 15 and make that comeback thanks to an onside kick and a last second drive to send it to overtime and then win it in overtime? Do you know how hard it is to do when the defense completely, other than one play, they stop Texas Tech on the ground, they pick off British comedy legend Alan Bowman 3 times, Sam Ellinger only throws 1 pick, they move the ball pretty well, at least in that middle section of the game, the first half especially. I think they scored, 30 points in the first half? You score 30 points in the first half of a game and you still have to claw back because you're down big is a wild way to live your life as a football program. And you're right. And we talked about this too with Tom Herman, where it's just like, if this is where they are this many years into Tom Herman's tenure, where they need to come back to win by double digits against a flawed Texas Tech team, not a horrible Texas Tech team, but one that just got by Houston Baptist barely. How old is your niece or your oldest niece?
Oldest niece is going to be 11.
What, 10, 11?
She's going to be 11, yeah.
She's going to be 11 years old. If you were to play her one-on-one on the basketball court and spot her 5 playing up to 11, but all of a sudden you're down 9-1, and all you're like, oh, I have to get my act together.
Yeah.
Quickly. I have to scramble and start swatting shots and being mean because I can't lose this game. It had that vibe on the rewatch, Ty. Absolutely had that vibe on the rewatch. And I opted out of Texas football and sort of pouring a lot of emotion into the Horns pretty early on in the season after games like this. But watching this game specifically, Texas Tech was really fun on offense. It was what, TJ Vasher made big plays.
Yeah, big dude.
Keshawn Carter. Like, it was an explosive play aganza. And that's the wrinkle to me is that, you know, Texas needs to pull out this game. They need that onside kick. They need that last second drive. And they need that pick to seal things. But it's just, if you are looking to, quote unquote, upset a team, you need to be turnover focused on defense. So taking chances and, you know, getting hands in passing lanes by, you know, your defensive line, whatever, getting tips, which Texas Tech was able to do. They turned turnovers into points. But also, you got to take shots. You cannot hope to nickel and dime your way to an upset win. No matter what Indiana was able to pull off, that is not a great strategy for defeating a team considerably more talented than your team. And so what Tech was able to do, 4 penalties for 15 yards, Texas 10 for 100. There's your hidden yards in this game. And even though Tech does out turnover the Horns, they also out explosive played the Horns. You know, that huge run from Sir Roderick Thompson, that's his name, was incredible. And the Texas tackling was so woeful all game long. They not only should have lost this game, they probably could have lost to Houston Baptist the way that they were tackling, especially early on in the season.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing for me now, headed into the Sark era, especially in light of what we saw last year, they have the same sequence of games: Texas Tech, TCU, Oklahoma.
Okay.
Earlier in the year, starting the end of September. So hopefully for their sake, it goes a little bit of a different direction and they're not winning by the skin of their teeth against Texas Tech and then losing to TCU and Oklahoma. But we'll see. I don't know. They'll have their chance to get some redemption a year later.
I almost can understand, and I can write off major tackling issues early on in the 2020 season when you don't have that same sort of live fall camps, you know, to get used to. I mean, it's about effort, but it's also about just comfort in a system. I can write off that to a certain extent for a number of teams early on in 2020. But with a fourth year starting quarterback to not have that kind of explosive offensive success all game long against Texas Tech, that's the part that seems inexcusable. They had big plays and then they just would become wildly inefficient, you know, the next drive.
Yeah.
So yeah. That to me was the takeaway that, like, yeah, this was almost more obvious than anything else. You know, they have the loss to TCU where they get pushed around on the ground, but needing overtime and giving up 50 plus points to Texas Tech, like, well, the program clearly hasn't arrived to an acceptable place. So yeah, it was a good hold on, I suppose, and it was a wildly entertaining game at the end of the fourth quarter in overtime. But damn, the wrinkles were there.
All right, and our final game here, Dan, is the big one. This is the big one. Coastal Carolina 22, BYU 17. So here is the lay of the land headed into this game. Coastal was 9-0. They were 18th in the college football playoff rankings, higher in the other polls. In general, though, just a ton of fun to watch. Kind of the darling of the 2020 season. A lot of folks didn't know who they were. Had the teal field, the shot
to Claire's. Had a bunch of close calls, too.
Bunch of close calls. They're fun to watch. And if you watch this game, if you watch any Coastal Carolina, they were legit fun as hell to watch because I think, as I've said time and again, their offense is a combination of every offense. Every offense that you like. That's what they do. They do everything. So that is the wrinkle for them. And Grayson McCall, their quarterback, the freshman, very, very good. No doubt about it. On the BYU side of things, they were also 9-0 headed into this game. Their quarterback, Zach Wilson, is going to get drafted very highly in the upcoming NFL draft. They were 13th in the college football playoff rankings headed into this game, but 8th in the Associated Press poll. So people thought very highly of the Cougs headed into this football game. This is my favorite game of the year. Favorite game of the year. And the oddity here was that it came together 60 hours before kickoff due to circumstances. Coastal was supposed to play Liberty, but the Flames had a COVID issue. Bunch of guys came down with it. They couldn't follow through and play that game. But BYU was also looking for an opponent. And so they made it happen. The game did not disappoint. The takeaway here was that both teams acquitted themselves quite well. For my money, the game of the year. The bigger thing, which we can talk more about after we talk about the game itself, was I think that college football should take another look at how it allows teams to schedule. We're so used to this policy of scheduling games 15 years in advance, the home and homes with Alabama or Ohio State. But this one came together a couple hours before, 60 hours before.
60, yeah.
It actually happened, and it did not disappoint. It was exactly what we needed at that moment in the college football season. Dax Milne for BYU stopped like a yard short as time expired. So a great ending, an awesome matchup. Mormons versus Mullets. So this had everything that you want as a college football fan. And a lot of people got into it. I remember they made a big deal of it on College Game Day.
Of course.
It was
Teal Field, Conway, yeah.
A great moment for both schools to be part of this. And truly, I don't say this lightly, truly this is what we needed in 2020 as sports fans, because so much of the season had been a flaming pile of you-know-what.
Sure.
Postponements, uncertainty week in and week out. They effectively steered into all of that and gave us the best game of the year. So I will always remember this game fondly. I hope BYU fans do as well, even though it didn't have the desired outcome. Just to be part of that, I think, is really unique and special in a otherwise strange season.
Agree. But still disagree with punting on fourth and two from your own 47 to close out the game. Still disagree with it, even though BYU drove the length of the field pretty quickly. And they got to, what, the 1 or 2 yard line where they were stoned to try to win this game because they're down 5. So they have to get into the end zone. So still disagree with that call. I thought because of how well Coastal played, and the wrinkle in this game is obviously what you mentioned, the Coastal offense and preparing for it with almost no time because of that option element, because of the unorthodox way that the Shonts play on offense where they can throw the ball, but there is that option element that's quite successful as well. That to me was the difference. And of course, the wrinkle of just not having time in general and traveling across the country, going from Provo to Conway, is it's got to be some kind of weird journey to connect those two places. So I understand all of that. In rewatching the game, it was so clear to me that watching Zach Wilson play football that it would have been far more interesting to watch him play. And this is no intended slight at BYU, to see him against bigger opponents, to see him on a bigger stage, to see him perhaps with a bigger time receiver. And I like this guy. It was a Dax Milne. And gosh, who were they? I mean, it was Tyson Algier in the backfield. You know, all these names start floating away from my brain when we get into this. Neil Pau. I think there was a Romney prominently featured with BYU. So there was something about this game with Coastal really bending and not trying to break that paid off. That is a way to win this game. But yeah, this game definitely had the feel of the wrinkle. It definitely had the feel of BYU not fully adjusting in those big moments to figuring out what Coastal can do on the ground, especially with Grayson McCall. I loved rewatching this game because this was one of those very rare games where you could kind of get a sense for the emotion involved in the stadium. I'm not saying any team was wrong to limit fans or have no fans, like, do your thing. I understand every cent of that. But also, there was something nice about, if you suspend everything in your brain, there was something nice about sensing the energy in a stadium for a big game that this game also featured.
Yeah. And I think to the point, just the fact that it was BYU, that it was Coastal Carolina, two teams that are not used to being featured on this kind of stage. It was very fitting of the 2020 season that they brought us as much joy as they did.
Do you think that, and I think the answer is yes, but that's my opinion. Do you think that there is something, or there was something so appealing about this matchup, not just because of the way it came together, but because the top of the sport, even with what BYU and Coastal are both undefeated at this point, do you think there was something inherently and newly appealing about two undefeated teams playing with no chance at playing in the college football playoff? No matter what you might have thought about BYU at the time, they were the more likely team, I guess. But no chance of the playoff, that this was, there was something refreshing about caring about a game, not having to do with the playoff, and also just it lived outside of the foregone conclusion section of the sport. That the teams that are so advantaged, like Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State, you know, Georgia, Oklahoma, all these schools, that there was something nice about watching this game that just had fun implications, not playoff implications.
Oh, for sure. Okay. For sure. And yeah, no, so I agree 100% there.
It's a pushback against that element of the sport.
Well, and you always have that with college football.
Right.
You had that with UCF. Remember when they declared themselves national champions and we had folks writing in, calling in, telling us UCF deserves a shot. You always have that underdog component to college football. And that's part of what makes it special. So the underdog story to me was first off that they played the game at all. And then secondly, that this got the kind of stage that it did because of how it came about. Because both teams to that point and through the season, frankly, had really good years. They're both up there, worth talking about, worth watching.
Oh, these were really good teams. Yeah.
I will push back a little bit, though, on the point that neither one had a shot. I think we know in hindsight, and I think we knew if we thought about it, if we really came to our senses, we knew that neither team was going to play for anything. But at the time, like, we were postponing games left and right. We didn't even know if there would be a playoff.
Right.
A bowl season, a postseason. So I think there was definitely an element here of not taking anything for granted moving forward. And that's what made this game as special as it ended up being. We just didn't know what the future was going to hold in football, in life. There's a lot going sideways.
I had forgotten about the fact that there was no love lost between these two 11.
No, they hated each other. It was contentious.
You had the halftime fight because of the way that Coastal players went after Zach Wilson when he threw that Hail Mary pick. And, you know, I think they tried to double team block him. Like, oh, this is an opportunity to hit him. With live play going on. And so there was a scrap at midfield at the start of halftime. So I like that inherent emotion.
And
fighting and getting hurt, but you know, it was nice to feel the bad blood.
Yeah, to feel that bad blood. It felt very authentic in a way that look, we talked to a lot of college football fans. A lot of people were very ambivalent about this season. They didn't know how to feel.
Sure.
And this authentically got the juices flowing. And again, to further my own point, they played this game on December the 5th. That was after Thanksgiving. We had cases starting to spike again. Just so much uncertainty about what the immediate future of the sport, of the country, of just life in general held.
Mm-hmm.
This game came at a really good time for us as sports fans. And I will forever be grateful. Sometimes I get a little too deep for my own good. I'm really grateful that we had this experience as sports fans because I felt we really needed it at the start of December.
The nice thing about these five games, and is it only true of the Indiana game where there was only one walk-off offensive winning play in these five, right? It's Florida missing the field goal. It's BYU being tackled short.
One-yard line.
Texas getting that stop. It's Oregon State getting that stop after taking the lead late and Oregon not being able to finish. And usually, that's always kind of a letdown, right? You want the game to be decided by the team who has the ball last in a positive way. You want to see that team get in the end zone with no time left or kick the ball through the uprights with no time left. There is something that's inherently romantic about that. But even watching these games back, that didn't really matter all that much to me. And the Penn State-Indiana game was clearly the worst full game to watch. And that was the only one that got decided offensively with a game-winning play. So a fascinating rewatch on all of these games. And I had remembered a lot of parts, but also had forgotten a lot of the context.
All right. Well, Dan, I think that's it. In looking back at these games, at these five games, for me, my favorite was clearly Coastal and BYU.
Okay.
Do you have another one that was your favorite instead?
Probably LSU, Florida.
LSU, Florida. That was a strange one too, wasn't it?
It was so strange, but just from a narrative perspective of Florida not having Kyle Pitts and LSU being down the players they were down and having the season that they were having and going on the road and just, I mean, there was no way Cade York could even fully make out where the uprights were from his vantage point. He's just like, I got to kick it into the abyss and hope for the best. That to me, that was like my Stephon game. This game has everything. So that is one of the last. And then the Marco Wilson element as well, throwing the shoe. So in terms of strange and upset, and it's still difficult to say upset with the defending champ, but it works in this case. So that's my pick for the craziest one.
Write in solidverbal@gmail.com. Let us know your thoughts. Also check out verballers.com. That is our Patreon. That's where you can find our off-topic show. It's going to drop on Friday morning, talking about personal tech. You know, I'm a bit of a geek, Dan.
As am I. Before we go, can you drop that quivering? Quenching? I don't know. Quilting? Drum and fife?
Who could forget about the Patriot League spring season, Dan?
Yeah, buddy.
Let's talk about your Fordham Rams on the road at Fitton Field in Worcester, Mass. Squaring off against the Crusaders, Dan. Who you got?
I mean, Fordham, obviously. I no longer live in New York, but I do recognize New York's one true team, Fordham Rams. Of course.
And I gotta they're go well Crusaders. Rested. Gotta go home team in these uncertain times, Dan. Give me the
Crusaders. I feel like everybody, there's so much money going to the Crusaders because of that win last week against, who did they play?
Lehigh.
Lehigh, that's right. Lehigh. We're going to look back on that Lehigh win like, of course, everybody beats the Mountain Hawks.
Speaking of the devil, Lehigh Mountain Hawks on the road at Colgate. Hello, old friend, at Andy Kerr Stadium up there in Hamilton, New York, Dan. We go way
Battle
back.
The beatings.
We go way back with Colgate. Traveled all the way out to North Dakota State to watch them lose handily to the Bison. But I got to go Mountain Hawks here. You know where I stand.
Lehigh lost demonstrably, right?
20-3. They looked very bad.
Still without a touchdown this spring. I'm going to go Gators here, Ty. I feel pretty, pretty good about the boys in maroon.
They're both in maroon.
Probably both maroon. Yeah, they're probably both maroon. The boys in Hamilton.
And finally, your Lafayette Leopards
Colgate
on the road.
Favored by 8.5, by the way.
Can I get a line on that game? Really?
Yeah. According to Caesars.
Hold on.
Colgate favored by 8.5. What was the other game you wanted to know the line on?
Well, I
the
mean,
Holy Cross game?
I'll take the line on any of these games. Fordham at Holy Cross.
Fordham at Holy Cross is no line for this one. It's on ESPN Plus. It's going to be 45 degrees, but I'm not seeing a line. Caesars had a line on the other one. Not this one. Sorry.
Okay. Finally, your Lafayette Leopards on the road at Bucknell. Bucknell is a 7.5-point home dog.
That's what I'm saying.
Playing at Christy Mathewson Memorial Stadium up there in Lewisburg, Dan. You taking the points here? What are you doing?
Everybody knows Leps travel. Absolutely. I am giving those points.
Whoa.
Double-digit win for the Leps. Easy. Come on. Do you not believe?
I don't believe. And I'm inclined to take points in all of these games. I feel like that there are actually a lot of college football games.
They beat the Gators by 2 touchdowns, right?
Yes.
Lafayette did. They're coming off a win just the other day in 2019 over Lehigh, at Lehigh. The energy's there, Ty. You know this. I know this. Lafayette.
How on God's green earth is Vegas going to set a line on any of these games?
I don't know, but I feel like if you know Pat League football, there's money to be made.
I feel like you should just take points.
Okay.
Just take the points in like every game.
Over under at 42 points. So Vegas has done their homework and they're anticipating something like a 24-17 type matchup here.
I'm locking it in right now. I'm looking this up. You know where I stand.
Are you going to bet the game?
I'm going to bet the game. Why not?
Bet it.
There's nothing else to bet. Other than all of the college basketball action, in which case I will also be taking the points because why
Bucknell
not?
Bucknell has not played a game in 15 months.
Oh, really?
Last game they played was a 17-point loss to Fordham.
And they're still only a 7.5-point home dog.
Right. Whereas Lafayette played a game. The cobwebs are off. The Leps.
I'm going $10 on Bucknell plus the points. Why not?
Okay. You can, if you feel really good about Bucknell, money line's at plus 230.
No.
Outright. Come on, baby. If you believe.
Let's not go crazy here.
Okay.
All right. Well, look, enjoy the NCAA tournament. We will be talking again tomorrow about...
do we have a bracket? Tech. Should we launch a bracket?
Do you want to?
Is it too late?
No.
I don't think it's too late. Yeah, let's launch a bracket.
The game starts Friday.
I like calling family members. Yeah.
There will be a bracket game. Just search for the Solid Verbal out on ESPN.com.
Yes.
We'll launch it there. We had a lot of people last year who did this. So
yeah, it's fun.
All right. I'll make picks. You'll make picks. It'll be a grand old time.
Done.
I will talk to you tomorrow, Daniel. We'll talk about personal tech, all right?
Verballers.com.
For that, go over there. Dan Rubenstein for myself, Ty Hildebrand. Enjoy the rest of your evening. We'll talk to you soon. Stay solid.
Peace.